Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK, and we are continuing our series on carbon impacts.
And this week, we're looking at all things transport. Trains, planes, and automobiles.
Bikes, boots, and buses.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Let's go!
So in this week's episode, we're going to be talking about transport. And like the last few weeks, we're going to think about the current state of play. And shock, shock, things aren't great again. The things which are good, which are coming down the line, which might change things somewhat. And then actually some really exciting things that have happened around the world to change all of this, which could actually make our transport system lower carbon.
Oh, that's exciting. So basically the bad, the good, our personal rants, and then quiz. I like it. All right. What's the state of play, Tom?
So transport is one of the areas that we are particularly bad at the UK. So 28% of all of our greenhouse gas emissions come from transport. This number hasn't fallen like other areas. Instead, we've kept this number particularly high. We've moved over to some electric vehicles, which is great, but we don't actually want to cut our transport emissions because people love their SUVs.
What's an SUV classified as? It's almost like a minivan, but just a different shape.
As my friend calls them, the Chelsea tractors, the things which are just obscenely big.
Chelsea tractors.
Oh, PK, I know it is. It's an American car. Any car which is suitable for an American road, that's pretty much an SUV, in my opinion.
I would say that is a spot on accurate description. That actually might be, if we Google it right now, what is an SUV? It's an American car.
I've got an American friend, and I remember the first time I chatted to him about like climatey things. I was saying, oh yeah, my car gets 55 miles to the gallon, but like sometimes if I'm really good, I can get up to 60. And he was like, what? Because his car, he got 25 miles to the gallon, and he was impressed with it. And he was like, oh yeah, it's just a truck. It's a small truck. And I was like, why have you got a truck? Why do you need a truck?
And his truck actually might be lighter than an SUV, because if he doesn't have anything on the back of that bed.
Get away with these excuses. You don't need a truck.
You know, we got to put our dogs somewhere. Tom, come on, you know. So what you're saying is 28% of our emissions are through transport, and that the rise of the SUV, the cars getting bigger and bigger and bigger, is keeping us from lowering these emissions. I mean, here we've got those tiny roads in the UK. It struck fear into my heart when I realized that I was going to have to learn to drive in this country. But I get it now. They were designed for smaller cars, just like our car parks. There's some car parks where we struggle now. But I like the small car as well, but my husband doesn't.
Oh, it's a controversial topic in the household, is it?
Yeah, we clash. I'm all for reducing down to one car for the three of us, but no, I think other families are having similar conversations.
Well, apparently the market share of SUVs, so the percentage of cars which are purchased in the UK which are SUVs, has gone from 7% in 2007 to 25% as of 2019.
Whoa.
And it just kind of shows like this exponential growth. And I think it also highlights the point that we talked about a few weeks ago, like this rebound paradox, that actually once we've got all of the free finance available, that we buy these elaborate things, or because these cars are slightly more fuel efficient, we feel like we can buy a bigger one and we get the same fuel efficiency as our smaller car from the past.
Yeah, humans are pretty gluttonous, aren't we?
It's not a good start. But SUVs is obviously a pet peeve of mine here, but there's all sorts of other transport emissions in the UK. And it's also important to say as well that in that transport emission, we don't really count aviation, because the UK government says, if it's an international flight, it doesn't matter. So we count some domestic flights within that 28%. But actually, the big, big hitting international flights, yeah, just ignore them. It's fine. Someone else's problem.
So is that including flights that depart from here and flights that come back? So all those international flights, none of those, regardless of origin.
There's a very short distance post takeoff that counts, but the duration of the flight, no.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Even more excitingly, we're expecting the aviation industry and flights generally to grow by between 2 and 4 times their current amount of flights by 2050. So the amount of flights we've got today, 2 to 4 times more in 2050.
Wow.
not only are we failing to address our transport emissions, as I said, it's one of the areas that's plateaued, and the UK is known to be a bit of a laggard in this. And the Climate Change Committee, which is an independent body which reviews various bits of work on climate change, they kind of say our transport strategy isn't up to the mark. Moreover, aviation is just set to get worse and worse and worse. We've obviously talked a lot about aviation in episode two, but it's one of those topics which we need to be starting to address a bit more deeply.
We got to make that happen.
Exactly. But my next question for you, PK, is how many extra cars do you think we add to the roads? This is globally every year. This isn't just replacing old cars. This is new cars.
Globally, I couldn't even come up with a number.
100 million new cars are added each year. So there are roughly 1.2 billion cars in the world right now. And that number is growing by 100 million every year. Not only is this problem bad, it's getting worse.
So in just 8 years, it's going to be 2 billion.
Exactly. And this is one of the big issues. It comes nicely to one of my big thoughts about transport. And obviously, a lot of this episode, we're going to be focusing on the car, I think, just because it's kind of the focal point of transport in the UK. And there's a reason for that. And I think that's because there's this philosophy and ideology which goes alongside it. And the car isn't just a vehicle to get from A to B. It embodies so much more than that in the British psyche, I think. It's a symbol of status. It's a symbol of look what I can go out and buy, rather than just it's a practical tool for me.
I agree. And it's similar in the United States as well. It's more than just a tool. It says something about yourself, your lifestyle. And for me, I am quite happy. As long as it's safe, I really don't care what it looks like. When I first moved here, the cars I was looking at, my husband decided that no, he bought a car for me. And I thought, is it because you don't want this car sitting outside of the house? He did say, it's because I'm worried about your safety. But I actually think it had to do slight bit with his vanity.
That's crazy. Because your partner is also quite an environmentally friendly guy as well.
Yeah. It was a secondhand, inexpensive car. It was actually a family car from another family member. And so we just bought it from them. And it was a great car, but I probably would have spent less, quite frankly, because I'm cheap like that.
I'd never got this with cars. Why would you buy a new car when you can go and buy one with 7 miles on the clock for literally a quarter knocked off the price?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've come to look at cars as an extension of who we are, instead of really just looking at them. What do I use this car for? And do I even need a car this big? Because most of the time, while we're driving around, we can look and see other cars, or if we're on the bus, we can look and see other cars. And most of the time, there is one human being in that car or two. And in addition to that, I believe when we own this car, most of us only use it 2 to 3 to maybe 4% of the time. The vast majority of the time, a vehicle is sitting parked somewhere unused.
Well, that also comes to the point that I'll be talking about later about autonomous vehicles, because all of a sudden, actually, we don't have to have a car sat around for 95% of the time doing nothing. Be doing things when you're not there.
Yeah. And the whole time we have the car, we're paying insurance on it when we're not driving it the entire time.
We've spent a bit of time now ranting about cars.
It's not going to be the last time in this episode.
No. But I think it's also important to recognize that the UK isn't great at public transport generally. But just to give you a bit of an example here, even over the last 10 years, £400 million has been cut from local bus services. That is an astonishing figure. It's no shock, really, that these things are expensive now. I've got a wonderful graph here, which shows me a selection of train prices per mile across Europe. And would you like to guess which country is the most expensive?
Is it the UK?
Which the UK is. The UK is the correct answer, at 55p per mile travel.
Oh my gosh.
This is just from one example train ride.
So then that makes it more likely that if it's going to be cheaper for you to drive your car, you will drive your car. I think it's no surprise to anyone that lives in the UK that our bus availability has increasingly decreased. Where in the village or the town that I live in, we have no buses on Sunday. And that impacts people who can't drive. Maybe they're too young to drive, but they want to go to another city to do a job. People who are not physically able to drive for a variety of reasons, the vision impaired, all manner of people, people who literally can't afford to buy a car. It's just minimizing their ability for a whole host of things to access other services, much less work.
So I gave up on the buses of Stoke-on-Trent 6 months ago because they stopped running at 5 o'clock and I had the joy of catching the 4:30 bus, which broke down. And rather than anything happening, the bus driver kicked us off the bus, drove off, and I had to walk 8 miles home. And I was just like, why have I tried to do something which is good for the environment and get the bus when the consequence is this? And I'm obviously lucky because I can drive if I want to, but like so many other people just stuck there then. What can they do?
I do know people that would not be able to do those 8 miles. And then what if it's in the wintertime and it's dark and you take your life in your hands on these tiny, 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 skinny roads that we have here? So what happened to everybody else on that bus? Did they have to do the same thing?
You know, I didn't chat to them, put my headphones in and just wandered off.
Did you just go see you and start jogging off into the sunset?
I was so grumpy afterwards. I was just like, ugh.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And I gave up taking the bus to the place where I volunteer, where I work at, because I'd have to leave the house so, so early. And also, I did calculate it was actually the petrol was cheaper for me because I'm insane about understanding the numbers. And every time I fill up my car, I document the mileage, and then I, you know, divide it by the gallons.
Every time you fill up your car, you take the numbers down and you divide everything.
Yeah, I do.
You know, there's a button on the car that does that, right? Like, you don't have to do the math yourself.
No, I look at how many miles. So every time I fill up my car, I reset it, and I always fill it all the way up. So that way, if I've used, usually I won't do it until I'm down to 3/4 of a tank. I can look and go, okay, on my car, I've driven this many miles in this period of time for trip A. And then I look at how much I've had to fill up for gallons of the petrol and then how much that costs, because then that way I like to see how much it's costing me per mile to drive.
I feel like I'm back in the 1980s here. Oh, I get the piece of paper out and I do the long division.
I can do this in my head, Tom.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Your generation perhaps doesn't know how to do math. I have this thing. It's interesting. It's a special organ in between my ears.
Only calculator for me, thank you very much.
My Japanese mother didn't allow me to have a calculator growing up. I had an abacus.
The electric car is obviously something that's kind of touted, especially in the UK, as the solution to decarbonising transport. And what do you think about that, PK? Do you think that's the thing that we should be looking to, the panacea?
I think it's an element, but I don't think it's the full solution. I feel like you're going to probably say the same thing.
I do think it's part of the solution. And obviously, like, we need to reduce the demand of the transport system. We need to increase public transport and active travel, like, massively, and also increase things like car occupancy. I know you said earlier, you usually look around, there's one person in the car. I think the figure is 1.6 people per average car journey. But I unfortunately think in the UK, the electric car is going to be the way that we try and solve this problem.
And you say unfortunately, why?
Because there are much lower carbon ways of moving than the electric vehicle. Electric cars have zero tailpipe emissions, but actually the creation of that vehicle is still a substantial amount of carbon. So roughly around about 50 grams of carbon per mile. Compared to a normal combustion vehicle, that's so much less. It's to about 225 grams of carbon per mile in a normal car. It still shows us that actually we're not getting to this zero carbon mark. We're just kind of looking at a stopgap here rather than a true solution.
Yeah, and it feels like we're sort of replacing things without addressing some of the other issues that we noted earlier. Where is, does everybody need a single-use car? Do we all need to be driving this much? Do we all need a car that's so massive that can fit 5 to 7 people when it's usually just one person?
The reason I think that electric cars will be the way that we go in this country is just because of the philosophy we've got so embedded in our country now. And like the thought of having to spend public money on things like train upgrades, which aren't HS2, MPs would just drop down the prospect of spending public money on trains.
Which is so ridiculous because it seems like it would be such a great idea. In the 1960s, the rail system in the UK was very, very robust. And I learned this when I went to CAT, the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales. And we could see the rail system, and you could see how you could get from Leeds to here to there. And then they showed over time how all of those lines dried up. It was basically like you were looking at a heart that's veins were just disappearing.
Good old Beeching with his cuts, eh?
Oh, that's right. You know all these people who enacted these different things. But Tom, we've talked a bit about the negative impacts of EVs, but there are some positives. So what are those?
Yeah, they are a much lower carbon option over their lifetime than normal cars. And they offer some other really exciting insights. So one of the really big and exciting prospects of the electric car is its ability to kind of act as a storage facility for electricity. So if you're somewhere, for example, your work or your office has solar panels on the roof, if it's generating excess solar power and your electric car is plugged in there, maybe you could charge your car with that renewable energy and then utilize that to have low carbon transport. But also, it's really exciting in terms of actually we could potentially go home with that electricity we've taken from work and power our homes and use that as a way to basically give us free electricity, because actually the batteries in cars are bloody massive and they're much bigger than you need to power a home. So this two-way connection is kind of the cutting edge of what's happening in vehicles at the moment and has the potential to unlock loads of really exciting opportunities for us of actually using a lot of the renewable energy available to us. And at the moment, there's lots of concerns about the amount of renewable energy which we can't store. But actually, using things like electric vehicles as a major storage mechanism unlocks so much potential.
Taking energy, renewable energy from the office and taking it home to power up your kettle, or in your case, your air fryer.
Yes. Oh, there is a really exciting thing as well, actually, like a really, really exciting part of it. So there was a paper released earlier this year, which looks at these things that they call super leverage points within our different systems. And these are basically things which could unlock like transformative change. And electric vehicles are one of those super leverage points. And the reason is because they can just operationalize so much storage and kind of facilitate the rollout of renewable energy and kind of the green industrial revolution, because all of a sudden we can have this storage capacity. So by allowing them to grow, we could actually unlock so much more renewable energy potential.
Well, that is good to hear.
But to get them working, the thing that we do need to do, and this is something that we're really failing at the moment, is having enough electric charging infrastructure.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's the infrastructure. With so many things, it's infrastructure.
Not only that, actually having the right sort of infrastructure, because there's like so many different types of charging systems. I was at a hotel recently, and I don't have an electric car, but we were there, and they had like a hyper fast charging point. And I was like, people are staying here overnight. Why do you need something which charges a car in 15 minutes for it to be plugged in all night? And there's all of this like wrong sizing of the infrastructure that people are doing, because there isn't really direction in terms of actually what you need to do right now.
Yeah, there's the fast charger. Obviously, that would be great at existing petrol stations, existing travel brake sites where you can charge up fast, because we do have an EV. And we certainly know what that's like to have to sit there and wait for any of the chargers. It's usually a long queue, and then you start talking to people. But that novelty is wearing off, quite frankly. You also have this issue where I think people also might choose a hotel because it has a fast charger, but it doesn't actually mean that they leave that charging station after the car's been charged for 15 minutes. They might go, oh, well, we'll plug it in and then we'll check in and then we'll take a shower and then we'll go down and have a drink or then we'll do this. So there were some systems, I think we talked about in a previous episode, where eventually you're going to have to be very judicious about your car charging, because if you leave it on for too long, it will start to debit your account to encourage people get off of it and leave that space available for somebody else.
Yeah. The lack of charging infrastructure is also very unequal. In the UK, 32% of all charging infrastructure is in London.
Wow.
And only 5.2% of that is in the West Midlands. And I think the one that really blew my mind is that in Newcastle, there's only one fast charger per every 30,000 people.
Wow.
And you compare that to London, where it's closer to one for every thousand, and you just see the massive inequality in access.
Who are all these people driving in London? I guess they're people commuting in and out for work. They don't necessarily live in London.
I guess it's also probably things like the ultra low emission zone, which are kind of forcing people to make those decisions.
Yeah, surprised. I guess when I think of a city, because I've lived in cities, although I have lived in cities and had a car, but previously Amsterdam, you definitely didn't need a car. You could totally just get everywhere you needed to by bike, train, trams. And then when you did need a car, you could always rent one. But what I really liked there, they had something, I think it was called Red Car. And it's just like an app. You know how you've been in cities where you can rent a bike, you know, and you just download the app and then you just see, shows you where the nearest bike is. So whenever we needed a car, say we needed to go farther out or we needed four people, we wanted to head out to the beach, you just look on the app and go, where's the car? And then part of the program is your insurance is covered as long as you have a standard driver's license. You go get that car, you pile in, you go drive the car wherever you want. When you're done with it, you just go, where's the nearest charge point that I can stick the car back at? And you go and stick the car there and then you leave it.
That's amazing.
It was fantastic. It was really, really fantastic. And I thought, why don't we have these everywhere? It's certainly more affordable than if I had bought a car, certainly more affordable than paying for car insurance and also for paying for, you know, your car checkups and things like that. So literally only using a car when I need a car. I'm only paying for that time.
And I guess the next iteration of that is the autonomous electric vehicle, which is the thing that I think is really exciting.
I like that too.
This could be the thing that changes everything. So there's an organization called RethinkX that does work around kind of like systemic tipping points where all of a sudden things transform. Bit techno-optimistic in my opinion. Nonetheless, they do some exciting bits. And around, like, especially autonomous electric vehicles, we only use our vehicles 5% of the time. If instead there was autonomous electric vehicles that went around, not only are we using them all the time and having a much more circular economy, there's also things like, actually, people aren't very good at driving efficiently. And by having these systems in place, we can make sure we drive efficiently. And, like, we can have good integration at roundabouts, and it's something since I've moved to Stoke-on-Trent, which I still can't deal with. It's the lack of indication.
Oh,
I just can't.
That is my pet peeve.
I can't get it.
I cannot stand that. That's what they're for.
All of these minute issues we could iron out. It's even things like platooning, where vehicles go behind each other and aerodynamic.
Ooh.
Reducing the amount of drag and therefore making them more efficient in general.
Yeah, I like that. I'm all for autonomous cars, by the way. But for everything you've just said, the efficiency of driving, fuel efficiency, but also it will, I believe, once it gets, you know, good enough in the sensors, it reduces the amount of accidents as well, because humans are bad drivers.
Not only are accidents obviously awful for the people involved, guess how much carbon is associated with a two-car crash on the motorway?
I have no idea. This is not even a scenario I've even thought about before. Should I go test it? All right, Callum, get your crash helmet on.
Get the measuring kit out. Roughly, a two-car crash on the motorway will equate to around about 40 tons of carbon being released. That's assuming both cars are written off, so they've got to be replaced, which is around about 20 tons of the carbon there. But then an extra 20 tons by people just being sat in that congestion and just generating excess emissions, it will hopefully mitigate a large chunk of those crashes, which come from human error.
Yeah, and then in addition to that, there's the domino effect of the impact it has on our healthcare services, having to deal with that, the impact it has on our workforce and our economy, not being able to go to work, potentially if you are the caregiver, all the domino effects that happen with that. Yeah. My husband, this is another thing. He's like, the idea of somebody else driving, that's not him.
What's the issue? He just can't accept the fact that the car's going to do a better job than him.
Yeah. I don't know if it's, he's just got to have control, but yeah, I am all for autonomous cars because it is good for daydreaming and thinking and coming up with good ideas while I'm driving. But I'd much rather be taking a nap, reading a book while the car is going about its business.
Is Morgan okay with things like the cotton press, that sort of thing? Is he?
You know, I'm just lucky he lets me work outside the home. I'm kidding. That's a big joke. He totally supports my feminist ambitions. In fact, he says I have more testosterone than him. But in terms of the car, definitely not. I am all for it. If there can be autonomous vehicles that you could just order and come and pick you up and take you wherever you go. And also, it'd be great if they're larger ones, you could car share, pick up other people with you. I think it's you know, just like you would with when you get on the bus or the rail, you're with other people.
It just depends if I've had a coffee before I've got in the car. Otherwise, everyone will hate me.
Do you want these cars to be equipped with toilets as well, Tom? That would be handy, wouldn't it?
That would be good, wouldn't it? I think we've just described a bus, by the way, like one of the big coaches. One final thing before we leave the topic. And this is the thing that people always kind of say is like, what about the battery at the end of its life? Like, what are you going to do with it? There is a concern there. It's a big chunk of hard to recycle material. But actually, there's some really exciting stuff coming out at the moment where people can take the batteries from cars and put them in their houses. So once they reach into their life, in a car, once it goes below like 80% efficient, you'll want to think about a new one. But in your house, that's still an absolutely enormous battery. And it'll be a really exciting development if we can actually take those ones out of cars and pop them in people's houses instead. And that'll solve some of the issues people have got in terms of actually being able to store renewable energy within their homes as well.
Oh, I like that. I like all this innovation. Yeah, sounds good. And one more thing on that car stuff. This isn't about autonomous cars, but we also need models and legislation that support different sort of policies. So there's a town in California where, say, I have my vehicle. If I live there, I have my vehicle. I only need it mostly one day a week, maybe 2 days a week. So there are, you know, string of days in a row I don't need my vehicle. But there are companies, insurance companies, that will let you rent out your vehicle. So sort of like it's a car share. And so you get to help out other people and you could set the pricing, but you can help out other people and other people go, I only need a car on Wednesday. And you go take my car. I don't need a car on Wednesday. And so we need models that and insurance policies that can allow us to have that kind of usage.
You led us on nicely to actually think about some of the exciting initiatives which are going on around the world as well. And the place that's particularly hurting for electric vehicles is Norway. Back in 2021, 2/3 of all passenger vehicles sold were electric. And compare that to around about 3% in the UK in the same year. So it just shows you the disparity in terms of actually 2/3, 66% of these vehicles being sold were electric. And the reason why is just because they've made a few policy tweaks. So you don't pay VAT on the purchase of electric vehicles. You have a 50% reduction in road tax. We get reductions in parking, reduction in access to things like ferries. But then also there was massive public investment in the charging infrastructure. So with a few tweaks to the policy regime, all of a sudden, everyone's buying electric vehicles. And they've moved a long way to solving the issue of emissions from road transport.
I think that's the critical element. You need a lot of good planning, good forethought, and then the investment from the government to make it happen. And I think what people don't realize is the government gets that investment back in terms of when we reduce those emissions, it is so much better for human health, you know, and we pay for that. So we might as well do that.
The other example I want to talk about, which is not car-based, was the recent French policy about flights. Have you seen that one?
No. Or I feel like we've talked about it and I've just forgotten.
This one is really cool. And I really hope we can do something similar in the UK. But basically, the French government gave approval, I think it was 2021 or maybe even 2022, to ban any flights of less than 2.5 hours. So domestic flights, which were basically short haul, less than 2.5 hours, they're gone. You have to get the train instead. The leadership to actually say, yeah, this is what we need to do.
Yeah, because as we've seen with everything, if there isn't a huge financial price tag to it as an incentive to not do something, people would be speeding all over the place and much faster than they do now if it wasn't for you get your license taken away or you could have a big fine. People wouldn't be wearing seatbelts, things like that. Without that government intervention, it's just not going to happen because we're just not going to do it.
And on top of that, it's not just flights which have done exciting things with their in France. So there's a 4,000 euro subsidy available as well for low-income households who are living in low emission zones to help them change their vehicles. I know the mayor of London's done some interventions to support low-income households in London as well.
And then we're going to help the people who normally can't take advantage of these things. Because as we've noted so many times, it's people with a bit of money and a bit of privilege that can take advantage of a lot of these savings and these vehicles that might use less petrol. But for a whole host of people who could benefit the most from it, it's just not happening.
This is not only going to be a quiz just for fun, it's actually a bit of a test in terms of how much you've taken in from this episode.
Oh, shoot. Was I supposed to be listening to you?
I expect notes.
So, all right, let's see how much I was listening.
Which of the following is responsible for the most transport emissions in the UK? So we've got HGVs, cars, the railway, buses, or vans?
Cars.
Ding! Any ideas on second place?
I'm going to say HGV.
Yeah. Both HGVs and vans contribute 17% of transport emissions in the UK. But HGVs are actually only 5% of the vehicles on the road. Cars are responsible for 61%.
Wow, I got that right. Woohoo! I'm doing a happy dance.
Next question. So we're gonna be comparing now. We're going to compare a Renault Zoe, the electric car, to a Range Rover Sport. I want it fully spec'd out, everything there, okay? So how many more tons of carbon, and this is embedded carbon from the creation of the vehicle, are there between the Renault Zoe and the Range Rover Sport? And just to give you a reference, the Zoe is around about 11 to 12 tons of carbon.
27.
So the Range Rover Sport, it produces 40 more tons of carbon.
40 more?
Just from the creation process.
So like 52?
So it's 49 to 51 tons.
I was going to go as high as 40 and I thought, surely not. Surely not.
And if we use the UK government statistics, which are somewhat questionable, that is the equivalent of 10 times the average annual UK emission. So,
holy cow.
If you go out and buy one of those fancy sports cars, that's the equivalent of you having your carbon footprint accounted for 10 years.
Wow.
Next question. You've already talked a little bit around the slashing of rail miles in the UK. So back in its prime, the UK had 23,000 miles of rail. Today, we have substantially less. How many of them do you think we've lost? Like either percentage or a number?
I'm going to say from 23,000 miles of rail, we now only have 13.
It's worse than that. We've lost over 50%. There's only 10,000 miles.
Wow, that's depressing.
Next question. I've already ranted about the cost of trains in the UK. Maybe I need to be more positive.
No, it's fine. You're fine.
How many times more expensive is a UK train compared to getting a train in Luxembourg? Is it 8, 10, 12, or 14 times more expensive?
8, 10, 12. I'm going to say 14.
It's actually 12 times. Thank you very much.
Still, 12 times?
I will say Luxembourg really tried to reduce the cost of their public transport. The reason is, though, because they have too many cars and the government's trying to actually be like, how do we get rid of these? And having low-cost public transport is one of the solutions for them. But saying that, we have a lot of cars, so...
Yeah, policy.
Next question. What percentage of all trips in the Netherlands were taken by bike in 2020? 10, 15, 20, or 25?
I'm going to say 25.
Ding! Correct. That blew my mind. Like 25% of all trips taken by bike.
It is amazing. It is amazing country.
And I think the big thing about it as well is like, it's not always been that way. There was an active decision to go towards bikes.
Wow.
Like it's not always been. I know obviously they've got the beauty of being somewhat flatter than the UK.
Yeah, but, that's very helpful.
But it was an active choice to go to a bike-centric country.
The infrastructure is absolutely there. I mean, it took me 4 months of living there before I got the nerve to start practicing and getting on my bike and understanding the system, because it looks quite scary when you're sitting there at a cafe in an intersection. But you've got your own traffic signal lights that are, you know, a lot of the times, but otherwise you go by the regular car lights. But it actually has a bike. It has a yellow bike, a red bike, a green bike. And it's just phenomenal. You cycle in your suits to work. It's just no big deal. And if you didn't want to take a bike, you could catch a tram anywhere. You could just catch a tram. Sorry, that was just my other observation.
I didn't want to interrupt. I felt like you're having a bit of a moment there.
Yeah, it was amazing.
So, you've made it through the quiz, and you've done well this week. You got two. You got two out of five.
Mummy, don't give up on me yet.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Ecocentrics. If you've made it this far, you've listened to us ramble on about transport.
But if you would like to suggest any other topics for us, you can let us know what future episodes you'd like to hear.
To do that, make sure you email us at hello@theecocentrics.com.
Or look us up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn.
And remember to hit follow so you never miss an episode.
See you next week.
Bye.
The Ecocentrics is produced by Emma Newman.
Theme and quiz music produced by Morgan Bryan.
Everything else is just done by the three of us when we have a random space to breathe.